The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. The Investment Fix podcast. Tune in today.
I've been thinking about this. I've been thinking about the sponsorship situation, yep. And I've got some ideas. Like, I reckon we could get a makeup brand on board, and Ben could do some Get Ready With Me videos when he's on his way out to different, like, political events and stuff. Yep. That could be cool.
Yeah.
Maybe some pet grooming, like, you know, like Pornhub or something.
What grooming?
Some pet grooming.
Pet grooming. You got any other?
I don't know, a brewery. Like, yep. We did. I mean, Ben is New Zealand's foremost craft beer expert, so, like, we could do that, maybe. Vaping? Like, I
Tēnā koutou katoa, this is Gone By Lunchtime. It's Wednesday, April the 17th, and with me, Annabelle Mather, kia ora.
Kia ora.
Ben Thomas.
Kia ora.
And National Treasure, Te Ahe Butler.
Tēnā koutou.
Kia ora.
A promotional message, first of all. We are doing a live podcast, I believe, on the 17th of May. That's a month today, as fate would have it. It's part of the Auckland Writers Festival. At last, Ben Thomas will step his foot gingerly into literary acceptability. It's a big moment for him. At the Aotea Centre, 4 o'clock on the Friday. Quite a good time, like gin hour or kombucha hour, if you like. You excited, Ben?
I just want to say to all my haters, see, I never had to write a book.
Well, maybe we could do a book. We can knock out a book by May the 17th, Bells.
David Cameron, before David, you know, because in the old days, United Kingdom prime ministers were expected in that sort of Etonian tradition to have written a book before they became prime minister.
Yes.
You know, just to show their sort of intellectual heft.
Quite right.
And when David Cameron was sort of maneuvering for the Tory leadership, he just had to bang one out really quickly. and it was something about, you know, studies in leadership, and it was like, you know, 10 leaders I admired, short essays, and ours can just be like 9 other podcasts we hate.
Oh, I love that. It's such a good idea.
I was speaking to a former high-profile New Zealander the other day who is flying to London with their child to go and see the Rest Is Politics live at the O2. That's the kind of fandom.
How old is this child?
I don't know.
Is it an actual child? A human child or a dog? Wow.
That's something, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, so hopefully we'll have people travelling from around the globe to this. It's going to be fun. All right, let's chunk through the big rocks. Let's knock them through the decision gates, everybody. We're going to talk today about AUKUS and independent foreign policy, public sector cuts, maybe a bit of history curriculum, a bit of Melissa Lee in the media inferno. Let's begin on AUKUS. Christopher Luxon is on a tour of Southeast Asia at the moment. I think he's in Thailand. He was in Singapore. Seems to be going quite well, except for one bit that I heard on RNZ where he was introduced by the Vice-Chancellor of Massey University as Chris Hipkins to an audience in Singapore. But, you know, that's fine. Anyway, he's having a good time, sort of a trade mission, I think. But there is obviously quite a big stormy, massive, tempesty badness and geopolitics, generally speaking. We're into the third year now of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There's, you know, Iran firing missiles at Israel in response to Israel firing missiles at a consulate, an Iranian consulate in Syria. We've got that kind of ongoing fragility around the South China Sea and that kind of perennial worry about whether or not China will move against Taiwan. And for us in New Zealand, on the fringes of all this. AUKUS is the subject of the day. AUKUS is a security pact between, as you can tell from the name, it's Australia, UK, and the US, and it's mostly about nuclear submarines.
Pillar one's about nuclear submarines.
Pillar one's about nuclear submarines, which will be ordered, you know, and arrive in Australia at some point in about 2072, the current rate, I think, of production. Then there's pillar two, which is, I guess, a bit like a bronze frequent flyer membership or something. You know, it kind of, you get the card and you get the name, but actually you're not really in it. It's just a sort of
pillar two is sort thing. Of like if you're organizing a night out with your friends, and then you've got a friend who's like, you know, a bit down on their luck and can't afford like the restaurant you're going to.
Yeah.
And then you decide to meet them at the pub afterwards.
Pillar two is
Pillar two is more like they give you their password to their Netflix, but you give them the password to Chris Luxon's TikTok account. It's more like that.
Okay. I was thinking, you triggered me, Ben. I was thinking it was like pillar two is like when Annabelle has a wedding and just invites you to the drinks bit later on. Which is still, I mean.
No one came to my wedding except my kids.
Well, yeah, okay. Well, they're pillar one.
Up to the reception. Never turn up to my stuff. Only Ben does.
So pillar two is, you know, sharing information about high-tech military systems and cyber warfare and AI and all of that.
And social media passwords.
And social media passwords and wedding receptions. But it really seems to be as much as anything about standing up against the strength of China in the what is now called the Indo-Pacific. There have been mixed messages in the previous government, I think, a bit between Naomi Mahuta, who's the foreign minister, and Andrew Little, who's the defence minister. Questions now have arisen about, as we appear to be moving via Winston Peters, who's been globetrotting lately, towards snuggling up into pillar two, that this compromises the long-held, decades-long independent foreign policy. Alan Clark has been particularly vocal on this in a number of spots, including Q&A on Sunday. And she said, what did she say? She said that she warned of a profoundly undemocratic shift in New Zealand's foreign policy. She's doing a Labour Party event tomorrow as well. Winston Peters, who was foreign minister in a Helen Clark government some time ago, said to critics, including Helen Clark, don't mislead New Zealanders with your suspicions without any facts. It's like there are a couple of kind of concerns. There's the economic one, China being the biggest trading partner, all that sort of thing. We don't necessarily seem to be cozying up to one side, but also the genuine independence that is afforded, which enables you, for example, as Helen Clark did, to contribute to the Afghanistan, to commit troops to Afghanistan, not to Iraq. And also recently we had New Zealand, I think, was the only Five Eyes member to vote at the UN for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, you know. And so the concern is that some of that independence is compromised if we end up allied with a side.
It's interesting because there's such a broad political range of commentators who are speaking out against it, you know, not just Helen Clark, but Don Brash, and they actually teamed up and wrote a joint article together warning the government against joining Pillar 2. Even today, Richard Preble has written a piece questioning why on earth New Zealand would be seen to be ganging up against its number one trading partner. Yeah. All good questions.
And I don't think it's going too far to imagine that John Key would be in that boat as well, given his, you know, his pro-China stance.
Absolutely. Yeah. It just makes no sense why New Zealand would be entertaining this idea. We had Nanaia Mahuta on Mata yesterday, and Mihi put that question to her. You know, it was actually under her government, her time as Minister of Foreign Affairs, that they started looking at a pillar two, a second pillar relationship with AUKUS. And she said that while that was true, they had only agreed to look at it, and it was almost an afterthought that they had been invited to. And I kind of got the impression that it was more of a manners thing to agree to look into it, but certainly no commitments were made. But as our panelist Jack Tautokai McDonald said afterwards, it kind of gave this government the cover to delve more deeply into exploring those options.
Right, and both parties, the Labor Party and National, where there's been, you know, a bipartisan consensus over the years on independent foreign policy, both parties are now saying, yeah, but we're just continuing our own position pre-election. But the reality is that Labor has cooled on it from where they were, and National has warmed up considerably, and National being in government is the one that makes the difference. Where do you sit on this, Ben Thomas?
A lot of people ask me about, where should we be going with AUKUS? And I'll tell you what I tell them. I say New Zealand must walk a tightrope between its strategic relationship with and alignment with the United States and our traditional allies, and also our economic alignment and relationship with China, our largest trading partner. And it's a tight road, and it's getting tighter
each day.
I've said it a thousand times yeah. on commentary, and like it's just words of lost meaning.
We were all getting quite sleepy.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know a lot about foreign policy. I find it, when I think about how variable and how incorrect the analysis of our own politics can be. You know, when I try and put my head into myself into the mind of, China going forward 50 years, the United States and the situation in Southeast Asia, and, I think it's probably fair to say I'm not particularly well qualified. At a bare minimum, in terms of the sort of rhetoric about independent foreign policies, as many of us know from our personal lives, if you don't make a decision, the decision gets made for you. And there's nothing particularly independent about kind of cravenly doing whatever China sort of nudges us towards in order to preserve our trading relationships. That's just a different kind of sort of vassalhood. So, I think Putin wrote a good column where he said, New Zealand has an independent foreign policy. Every country has an independent foreign policy. Every country does what it needs to or what it perceives to be in its best interests in the international order. But sometimes that will mean, more formal tie-ups with other countries in the same way that it will mean fair trade agreements with, say, China. So, I don't think the political rhetoric on it should be too persuasive either way. There is a very real risk to our trade, I suppose. If we draw closer, the Australians withstood trade blockades, on their steel products, but Australia is a much more significant producer and is much more internally self-sufficient than New Zealand. If we were to take away our China trade, disaster ensues. So unfortunately, you come back to the kind of tightrope. I don't think there's necessarily a right course of action, right now. What you can say is that we have been drawing closer. There was that announcement about the Chinese hacking, which actually sort of took place about sort of 2 or 3 years ago, but they decided to make a statement now in order to support our Five Eyes partners. So, I think you can see the way that it's tracking. Is that the right way to go? Not for me to say.
I'm not a foreign policy expert, but I did fly Qantas last year. And all countries have their own independent foreign policy, but unlike America, ours doesn't involve going off to war with other people every 15 minutes. You're right, Ben, we shouldn't be, our foreign policy shouldn't be dictated by being dependent on China. But nonetheless, we are very, very dependent on China. We have no free trade agreement with the US. And frankly, I'm not sure with the possibility of Trump becoming president again, if it really would be in our actual best interest to be aligned with the US. The main threat facing our region at the moment is not actually China, it's climate change, and this does nothing to fix that or make things more tolerable for our whānau in the Pacific, and it's them that will ultimately pay the price for any sort of standoff between China and the US. If I was, reading some of the press releases, and it talks a lot about, keeping peace in the region and that sort of stuff, if there was a word cloud with US, I don't think peace would be the big word that most New Zealanders would think of when we're talking about the US. And actually, we are far better off to keep our own counsel and to not align with any of them, except when it suits us on a case-by-case basis. But if we join AUKUS, it is very much seen as an antagonistic move towards China, and I just don't see how that can be any good. To me, it appears to be such a colonial mindset that we automatically team up with countries like the US and Australia, who don't do a lot for us, you know. Our whole ANZAC relationship, and we had all the 501 debacle, we don't have a trade agreement with the US, they don't do anything for us. Why are their interests our best interest? Except to say that, like us, they're colonial countries, and so that's where we tend to fall. But I think strategically we're far better off to remain truly independent. We're in a position where at the moment we can speak out against China when we see human rights violations. We can do the same against the US, so why we would need to join AUKUS, I just don't understand why. Except that, you know, we have a Prime Minister who sees himself as very much aligned with the US in general because he worked there for so long, and I think Winston Peters, who would like to get a trade deal with the US, but again, I think that we are far better off to maintain our mana motuhake in the Pacific.
What about if we could go for a pillar three, a pillar three and a half? And
what do you get with that?
Just focus on, sort of wine festivals and steeplechase and that sort of thing. Just keep it purely.
I mean,
soft
what
power.
Is the point of submarines? You can't even dive off them to go get kinners or power. Like, they're completely useless. You're stuck inside them.
Okay.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Hello, for lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-Off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-Off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
All right, we're about 6 weeks from Budget Day now, and I've had conversations with various people, as I'm sure you all have, who are going into their offices in Wellington, taking deep intakes of breath to find out which jobs are going to be cut and which aren't and which are under review and which aren't. I should hasten to add for the benefit of Nicola Willis that I don't flat with any public servants. But it is definitely happening at the moment, and we've seen it emerge in news headlines in various forms, both in terms of the kind of quantum, the numbers of jobs that are being removed, but also the headlines. We had the suicide prevention office was the most prominent one, and that's been, I think, mostly U-turned, that won't be cut after all. There's the school lunches program, and then there was the sort of the debacle over Whaikaha, the Ministry for Disabled People, which is a slightly separate case in that they were running out of money anyway. But there has been, how much of the way this is playing out in terms of those examples is, you know, the Americans have this idea of the Washington Monument Syndrome, which is when there are cuts that are demanded, the first things that will be put forward are the most beloved and prominent examples. So the National Park Service needs cuts, it's going to get rid, you know, it's going to neglect the Washington Monument. How much of it is that, and how much of it is, well, everything is getting a haircut, and that includes a lot of things that are doing a lot of good?
Yeah, I I think some of it is strategic and some of it is a result of sort of other circumstances. But that's right. There is this sort of, I think there is this interplay where, you know, when I was in the Key government, ACC was asked to sort of make savings along with everyone else. And I think the first thing they offered up was no counselling for sexual assault victims. You know, and you know that that's going to be completely unpalatable to the public and to the politicians. And, you know, in the kind of Sir Humphrey, yes, minister mold, they would then expect that the government says, oh, well, okay, well, we won't cut ACC. In reality, what happens is there's a bit more of a kind of back and forth on it. And, you know, one of the interesting issues is that this idea of sort of, you know, in opposition, politicians will talk about doing the line-by-line reviews. They say, we're going to go through the government's books line-by-line to, you know, cut waste. But ministers don't actually see line-by-line accounts of departments. They could be in the portfolio for 9 years and never actually look at the accounts of that department. What they see is the votes or the appropriations at budget. And that's sort of at a program level or, you know, at a very high level. There's certainly no line item that says waste or bloat or
excess having a nice stuff, time,
right?
$10 million.
Yeah, that's right. You know, like, you know, unnecessary poverty, you know, $2.5 million, you know, brackets do not cut, you know. But, you know, the what we call the waste is not sort of, you know, lying on the ground like toxic sludge or whatever. Instead, it's sitting in comfortable chairs. And, you know, may not, you know, waste doesn't necessarily know it's waste because people in the public service are all busy. They're all doing stuff, right?
Plus it's super subjective, eh? Like what one politician, one party might think is wasteful, another one might think is crucial to their agenda.
Yeah, for sure. And that's when you get to the sort of program level where you're sort of like, oh, we don't need this, we do need this. And that's actually the easiest one for the ministers to cut. But it's the one that raises the most risks because then people say, oh, you're getting rid of the suicide prevention office? Holy heck. Now, the interesting thing about the suicide prevention office is actually it was gutted by the creation of Te Whatu Ora because Te Whatu Ora got the commissioning power, which is to say the funding for suicide prevention programs, that was delegated to them from the Ministry of Health. So the suicide prevention office was basically just a data collection sort of site with, you know, a little bit of sort of suggesting some kind of policy increments. It was down to a handful of people. In a weird sort of thing, the suicide prevention office, former commissioning powers for suicide prevention, were then actually delegated by Te Whatu Ora to the Māori Health Authority for some reason, which no one can seem to explain. And now it's back with Te Whatu Ora. But so when you talk about cutting the suicide prevention office, you're not really talking about what I think most people think. You know, you're talking about a handful of sort of data staff. And I think the trade-off is that they'll keep most of those staff, so the suicide prevention office, air quotes, will continue. But actually, all the funding is in Te Whatu Ora now, or Health NZ, or whatever we're calling it. But yeah, in terms of the waste sort of overall, you know, it will play, you know, a lot of the times it turns up as, you know, you've got a team doing OIAs for the ministry, you've got 10 people, two of them are senior managers, three of them are principal advisors, and actually the work could be done by, you know, six relatively junior staffers, and maybe that's sort of a few hundred thousand dollars of waste. But the ministers have no oversight on that sort of level of spending. So they trust in their chief executives, which one gives the chief executives a chance to play a bit of political mischief in order to secure their borders.
Do they not see the lines, though, Ben, because they're not allowed or because they just can't be asked actually going line by line?
Well, I think going line by line doesn't tell you anything. You know, it tells you there's a staff cost.
But it gives you something that you can dig in further and ask questions about, right? You can be like, do you need 20 staff in here kind of thing?
I mean, this is one of the fascinating things, right, is the actual lack of oversight that even the management have of their own departments. Now, this is a separate thing, but, you know, when Wayne Brown became the mayor of Auckland, he asked for an organisational chart of the council, and the staff at the council told him that was impossible. No such chart existed, and they couldn't compile one because of the complexity of staffing and the organisational structures. So he asked for an organisational structure just of the top four tiers. So the chief executive, that's one tier, then the deputy chief executives or group managers under that, that's another tier of eight people, and then, you know, their direct reports and then their direct reports. And again, the council said, we cannot do this. We are unable to furnish you with that chart. And within the government departments, you know, it's not totally clear that the chief executives do understand if a particular unit is overstaffed or if a particular unit isn't doing anything particularly productive. And part of that, I think, is because the public service, I think, strangely was sort of disempowered during the last 6 years because they didn't get adequate direction from inexperienced ministers. Instead, whenever there was kind of a gap, they just asked for more money. They pushed on an open door, which led to a room full of cash and dollar bills, and then they made more staff hires. And so it's not even totally clear that the public service knows what the sort of optimal, you know, levels of staffing or whatever, you know, where they can cut fat without hitting bone or organs. So it's a very fraught exercise, and there will definitely be mistakes. You know, some crucial things will be cut because this is an imprecise exercise.
And there's also a question of whether or not it's an effective use of ministers' time to be delving into the detail, as David Seymour, you know, seems to be presently investigating the particular procurement of tomatoes and sandwiches for school lunches in order to save the most amount of money. The bigger question, Annabelle, is overall, as we bound our way towards a budget, that the political argument can be made that this whole exercise, including some things that may be wasteful, but also some things that may be effective, is being undertaken as part of a cause to achieve tax cuts across the board and substantial tax relief for landlords.
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about cutting school lunches but giving billions of dollars worth of tax cuts to landlords, you have to wonder what the point of the exercise is. And again, you know, whether a government department is overstaffed or not is very much in the eye of the beholder, and I'm not sure that taking an approach which is strictly about cutting percentages is the ideal way to get maximum benefit to the taxpayer. Probably it's better to be looking at more of a target approach. What is it that you're wanting those departments to achieve, you know, so that it's like, yeah, focusing their 100%. Cuts around, or, you know, it's about getting more bang for your buck rather than just like cutting bucks out and potentially losing your bang as well.
I think one of the other things which is interesting, and this comes back to you alluded to, I thought, a slightly graceless comment from the finance minister that, you know, staffing cuts in the public service were only getting coverage because some journalists flattered with public servants. I think that's wrong. I mean, the government campaigned on cutting waste, so any cutting of waste, I would think they would say, was a good news story, except when it includes the words suicide prevention office or whatever. But I think it is interesting the way that they have been covered as largely human stories. You know, they have been about the effect on, first of all, you know, the individuals. You know, what are they going to do? How are they going to pay their mortgages? What jobs can they go to if the public service is in contraction? And also, even, I think, more slightly bizarrely, as a Wellington story, what's Wellington going to do without all these highly paid people spending at bars and cafes and restaurants?
And personally, I think that's great, because during an election, we completely dehumanise our public servants. They become this sort of gelatinous blob of people that we hate, and we forget that all of the services that we rely upon, like having a nurse to, you know, give your kids the care that they need when they're sick, or you know, not having all of our native birds become extinct in the very near future, and all of those things that we take for granted, it's good to put a human face on it and remind ourselves that these are people that are actually working hard to try and achieve good outcomes from the public. And if they're not being well managed, that's not necessarily their fault. And absolutely, as a public, we're allowed to ask questions about whether we're getting, you know, a great return on our investment in them. But they are people, and they shouldn't just be treated like some burden upon us when actually they're there to do good. And, you know, there's the writer's very effective about always running this argument that that we're bloated in terms of, you know, public servants and all of that. But actually, are we? Do we really want to have these services or not? Because it requires people to do all those things.
Well, I think there is an interesting point there, which is that I think it was last week Sanitarium announced job cuts as well. I think about 50 people, which is about the same as, say, the Ministry for Pacific Peoples is looking at cutting. And in terms of the coverage, it was really focused on the discontinuation of honey puffs. And now there's two things there which I think are interesting. The first is
Which is why the plurality of voice is so important, because some of us really care about honey puffs. Honey puffs are an iconic
they stay fresh
morning.
All the time.
They are part of our national identity.
And the two important things are, one, that I love our media, but I think it is a little easier for them to relate to white-collar professionals who are losing their jobs. And second of all, the sanitarium workers produce a thing that people can miss.
You can't necessarily get
that from the IMBY staff or the IMBY contractors who now will not be able to make 250 grand a year from their 40-hour week, which is, you know, one of the case studies that was sort of in the media recently.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the difference is that much as honey puffs are an important part of the nation, when you have an entire sector almost entirely concentrated in one part of the country, there are knock-on effects from that scale of change that don't exist in the more sort of isolated examples. So, of course, there's going to be coverage of all that.
I agree, though, that we need to give better coverage of our factory workers and all that sort of stuff when they're getting laid off, we can not give them the analysis and coverage that's required. So I think that's fair cop.
Now, in other job loss news, the New Zealand media continues to convulse from one part to the other. The bad news is that the Gone by Lunchtime proposal to fill the hole on News Hub and do the 6 o'clock news every night in this manner was rejected. The good news is that Stuff's proposal was accepted, and so a kind of a more economic and no-frills, call it what you like, version of the 6 o'clock news will exist, created by Stuff and put into News Hub, and that means hopefully at least some of the excellent News Hub journalists will be returned in that roundabout form. Meanwhile,
it's disappointing because I felt like our proposal was really innovative, was like not actually having news stories
just doing
or
this.
Scripts,
just,
like just chat,
just
improv.
Takes. Yeah,
that was innovative, but whatever.
You know, playing out recriminations between the three of us over the course of a commercial TV hour. So anyway, no luck with that, but we're still interested in talking to other people if they want something like that as a news product on their TVs. Apart from all that, I mean, the Melissa Lee thing is still captivating to me.
Sorry for Melissa. I mean, sorry, do you want to explain it in intro?
Well, it seems as though I assume what you're expressing is that she has found herself in a position where she is, like something out of a Samuel Beckett play, unable to actually speak of the cabinet proposal in any detail apart from maybe nodding to the possibility that it exists because you don't want to incur the wrath of your coalition partners.
It feels like cabinet has subscribed to the Fight Club model. Like, if you're in cabinet, you can't talk about being in cabinet, just like
and,
Fight Club.
And remember that during the election, Shane Curry asked the Media Insider at NZ Herald.
The Media Insider.
He asked for National's broadcasting policy, and they said, we're not releasing it because we're doing a small target focusing on the economy thing. And, you know, and when asked about it, Melissa Lee said, oh, you know, there is policy. And I know there's policy. I've talked with Melissa Lee about that in opposition. There's, you know, she's done a lot of work in various aspects of broadcasting. But there was no policy release because it didn't work in with the election strategy, i.e. no distraction.
Yes.
And now she becomes a minister. You'd think at this point probably allowed to talk about policy, but nope.
Talk about the portfolio? No, not at all. It's like it's like she's got a cabinet. It's like she's been super injuncted by the New Zealand First Party, you know. So she not only can she not talk about the contents of the cabinet paper, she can't even acknowledge that a cabinet paper exists. Mm. At a certain point, she's going to say, I can't even tell you whether or not I'm the broadcasting minister, whether I may am. In fact, Melissa Lee, I cannot get into any of that.
And in fact, funnily enough, I was listening to her do an interview the other day and she went to call herself the broadcasting minister and then she had to correct herself midway through and say, I mean, media and communication. Can I just pick up on the point that Ben made earlier about sanitarium? Because I feel like the same.
We just completely changed.
I know, but I feel like the same applies in the media industry. Because you know, we look at what's happening with News Hub, and we think about the journalists and presenters that are there, and what an awful time they're going through. But you know, what people forget about is all of the crew that work at News Hub, like the studio directors and the, you know, the DAs and all of those people. And they are so incredibly skilled, and you can't do what they do at TV3 without them. Their skills are not easily transferable, so it's not like you can just go and work easily somewhere else because you're working on a very specific type of software and all of that stuff. And my heart really goes out to those guys because they're incredible at what they do, and they face tough times ahead, and they don't get the headlines or the commentary that our colleagues do, just by virtue of the fact that when you're on TV, of course, you get a bit more attention. But I really feel aroha for those guys and the uncertainty they face, and I don't think the proposal that was put forward yesterday really provides much clarity for what's going to happen to them either. So just want to acknowledge those guys.
Before we sign off, we wanted to touch on the history curriculum that is in headlines lately. Annabelle?
Oh, so there was a report that came out the other day about, you know, kind of it was literally like a survey of a survey report on a survey of a survey of how the New Zealand history curriculum is going, which obviously now includes much more about Te Ao Māori, New Zealand Wars, all of that sort of stuff. And one of the things that talked about in the report was that while Māori students are really enjoying it and teachers are enjoying teaching it, that, you know, some of the difficulty has been, you know, developing the curriculum in terms of what sort of stuff they should be talking about. You know, and I have a certain amount of sympathy for schools in that position, like, and I think probably the Ministry of Ed should have been a lot more active in helping to develop resources and all of that sort of stuff for them. One of the criticisms was that it focuses too much on regional and national and not enough on, like, the global. And I saw Erica Stanford came out and said that, you know, she wants to restore greater balance and the curriculum needs to be clearer and, you know, she doesn't want other social sciences like geography to be crowded out by it. I don't know exactly what that means, but what I do want to say is, having now completed our latest chapter of the New Zealand War series and currently working on a documentary about perpetual land leases in Aotearoa, how crucial it is that this history continues to be taught in our schools. When I was at high school, we did the civil rights movement, the Troubles, and the Russian Revolution. And while those were perfectly interesting things to learn about, I really should have been, I should have been learning about the New Zealand Wars and all of that sort of stuff, because it helps us to understand our country. And I feel like a lot of the resentment that's been stoked up in the last few years over things like Māori wards and all of that kind of stuff, if people actually understood the history of our country and they realised that Māori, we're not actually getting special treatment, we're getting a little bit of parity after a century of severe oppression, that we would have a much more inclusive society than what we have right now.
Well said.
Yeah, not really anything to add to that. You know, working in treaty settlements in government, what we found was the more that people understood the history, the less, you know, the less concern there was, not just opposition, but the less concern, you know, people, you know, would realize that, you know, great wrongs had been done and needed to be sort of, you know, correct, well, not even corrected, you don't even sort of touch the sides in terms of the historical settlement process, but you've at least got to make some sort of gesture towards, you know, as Finlayson would say, restoring the crown's honor. But also doing something to address the land loss, and it's called redress because it's not compensation, it's not the full amount, it's not even close. And I think, and it puts a lot of other things into context, you know, in terms of, you know, why iwi Māori would have input into resource management decisions, you know, those sorts of things. I think there was a risk with the curriculum that it sort of overdid it. You know, I think there was some criticism of the curriculum that it was almost wholly focused on sort of the experience of colonization. And I think there, you know, there's other things in New Zealand have happened since then, obviously related to that. You know, and so maybe they're all still searching for the balance, but yeah.
I mean, the irony is that it's history, and the people that have the longest history in this country are Māori, and everything that's happened since then has to be seen through the prism of colonisation, because that's how, but that doesn't have to be a bad thing. That doesn't have to make other people feel lesser or any of that. It's just our common experience now as a multicultural country, that it is founded on a history of colonisation, which is not unique to us. You know, this has happened throughout the Commonwealth, and it's not something that we need to shy away from or protect our children from. And through it, we're able to have a global experience and look to countries like Ireland and the Caribbean and all sorts of places that have experienced similar things and how we have developed and changed as nations as a result of it. So, again, I think words like finding balance in this context can actually be really dangerous.
I mean, to be fair, I remember in a year of history when I was at school getting quite a good balance. We did both the Elizabethan era and the Jacobean era.
Oh,
so, you know, you had yeah. full scope of covering. All right, that's enough. Let's go. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Annabelle. Thanks, Tiahe. Thanks, listeners. Thanks, Bad Boys of Bricks. Talk soon.
Kia ora e te iwi, Tiahe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.